The fairly large task we have to do, which is of course the historical background to Isaiah and actually the introduction to Isaiah, which is the first five chapters. So rather than doing a reading, I thought we can just go straight into it, and hopefully by the end of today you'll have a good appreciation of the amazing man that Isaiah was and the really incredible time period that he was ministering in. Now, you can let's turn up to Isaiah just to start with, and this is the first verse of his momentous prophecy, which extended over a considerable part of time. The vision concerning Judah and Jerusalem that Isaiah, son of Amos, saw during the reigns of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah. So, he reigned, he prophesied over about a 60-year period. We know that because he came, it was the last year of Uzziah's reign that he came to answer his commission and start his prophecy. And we know he was still prophesying when Sennacherib came into the land in 701. So we've got about a 60-year, 59, maybe 61 time period which Isaiah prophesied over, which was quite an extensive time period. So today what we hope to have is some appreciation of what Judah was like at that time, Jerusalem, and what it was like living during the reigns of those kings that are mentioned there in the first verse. Probably the most significant thing that had happened in Jerusalem and in the whole land just before this time period was the great earthquake of Uzziah. We know it was a massive earthquake. We know that the earthquake in Zechariah is compared to that earthquake in Uzziah's time. So try and get into your mind a city of Jerusalem that has actually been devastated by an earthquake. Many of the villages and around the land, there would have been evidence of a massive dislocation because of that earthquake activity. So Isaiah's coming in to prophesy at a time of turmoil, physically, because of this massive earthquake that we know that happened at the end of Isaiah's reign. So Isaiah himself, his name literally means the Lord saves, and as I said to you, we know he prophesied in this time period about 740 BC till about at least 681 BC. We don't actually know what happened to Isaiah, but Jewish tradition has it that he fell to one of Manasseh's purges of the faithful in Israel, and we believe that that reference in Hebrews 11, where some was torn asunder, applied to Isaiah, and that's how the Jewish tradition has it. And you think, you know, Manasseh was Hezekiah's son who purged the land of all that idolatry, and his son came in onto the throne and embraced it so wholeheartedly to the point where he could even kill this amazing man who has been such a faithful support to his father. And the mind boggles in trying to understand how that total turnaround could happen. And you can only believe that Manasseh as a young boy was heavily influenced by people in the court who were trying to change the direction of the kingship in Judah. So let's have a look at a little bit, have a look at Isaiah, the person himself, and we'll have a look at his message, and particularly then the first five chapters. Now, we know he lived in Jerusalem. Some people suggest he might have even been a prince of a royal line. I can't find the evidence for that. I was scratching around yesterday, and I just can't see that. Some people think he may have been a cousin of Isaiah. So if anyone has any information on that, I'd love it. We know he prophesied in Judah. The reason being, of course, Israel was gone into captivity with the Assyrians by this stage during the reign of Hezekiah. So he had, even though Israel was there in part, it was taken captive, and then he was particularly prophesying to the people in Judah and Jerusalem. Now, what was Jerusalem like in those days? When we look at his prophecy, you can see that there was an enormous gulf between the rich and the poor, between the faithful and the unfaithful. Those who are embracing idolatry and those who are trying to remain faithful to God. We know he was married. He talks about his wife being a prophetess. I think that's in chapter 5. And we know he had two sons, which had these amazing names, which we haven't come up in yet in Christadelphia, but I suppose there's plenty of scope still. Shear Jashab, which talks about a remnant shall return. So both of these sons had a prophetic message in their name and themselves. So in spite of everything that was happening in Israel, the idolatry and the fact that they were going to go into captivity, Israel with Assyria, Judah with Babylon, there was going to be a remnant. A remnant will return. And that was a wonderful message of hope in the first son's birth. The next one, Mariashela Hashbaz, refers to, has this little meaning, quick to the plunder, swift to the spoils, and it's a prophetic message about the Assyrians and the Babylonians who were going to come in, and they were going to plunder Israel, the Assyrians, and then later Jerusalem and Judah with the Babylonians. And so we've got tragedy in both of these sons insofar as we knew that there was going to be devastation, and to have that devastation, there's just going to be this remnant that would return. Now, let's have a look at the book itself. You know, it's a big book, and the first part of the book really deals with judgment. It's very, quite aggressive in some parts, but when you listen to Isaiah or you read Isaiah, the language that he has is absolutely beautiful. He's very poetic. He has a very rich language, and what I was doing as I was driving down, I listened to the NIV rendition of it, and I just love it sweeping over me, and often as we go to bed we'll listen to a couple of chapters, or as we drive to work we listen to our readings, but listening to somebody else read it allows you to get into it. And when he was reading, this man in the NIV was reading and was talking about the desolation of the country, I get this image here of this Jerusalem that was so desolate because of particularly the earthquake that had taken place. So the first few chapters up to chapter 39 are talking about events that actually occurred while he was ministering. But the last part of the book, chapters 40 to 66, are written particularly during his latter years, relating to prophecy and the message of hope that was to come. So he saw a lot of devastation in his life. And we'll have a look at that with the invasion of Tiglath-Pileser and Sargon and Sennacherib and the plundering that took place then. And that's the judgment that he talks about in those first half of the book. But he knows that beyond that there's the hope and the comfort, amazing comfort that he gives to the people in spite of all this tragedy. Now, with this comfort then from the last half, and if you listen to these, you'll see that it has this beautiful movement in its message towards God's kingdom on earth, right? No more the idolatry and the abomination that was going on. We're going to move away from that to the kingdom of earth. No longer are you going to have corrupt rulers that were manifest then, but no, we're going to move to a righteous ruler. So this lovely progression of hope, and that's what the message is moving to. There's going to be righteous subjects, no more steeped in their pagan worship. The earth was going to be restored, no more is it going to be desolate. The people would be restored, and there would be amazing praise for the Holy One, the one who made it all happen. So that's the direction of Isaiah, but the first part of Isaiah has none of that, really. There's a little bit in chapter 2, but this is what it's moving towards, these beautiful themes of restoration, praise, and righteousness. But let's have a look at what it contrasts here with in these first few chapters. Have a look at let's look at these verses so you can get the power behind them. All right, we're moving towards this lovely righteousness and dedication and comfort at the end. But look what it's like here. Like chapter 1, verse 2. Not tragic. Look how the people have responded. I reared children and brought them up, but they rebelled against me. That's how they responded to God. They were rebellious. In verse 4, sinful nation, a people loaded with guilt, a brood of evildoers. These are God's people, and this is how they've been, how they've become over time. Totally lost their way. 1 verse 7. Your country is desolate, your cities burn with fire, your fields are being stripped by foreigners right before you, laid waste as when overthrown by strangers. Oh, terrible desolation. So you've got a tragic picture here, where the people are rebellious, they're scornful, the country's desolate. Come over to chapter 2. Verse 6. The people, they are full of superstitions from the east. They practice divination like the Philistines. They clasp their hands with pagans. There's no end to their chariots. Look, verse 8, the land is full of idols. They bow down to the work of their hands, to what their fingers have made. You think, how could the people of God get to this stage? And this is the background that Isaiah is coming to and appealing to. And chapter 5, and verse 13. Therefore my people will go into exile for lack of understanding. Their men of rank will die with hunger, and their masses will be parched with thirst. Therefore the grave enlarges its appetite. And so you have these people who are going to be captured, deported, both by the Assyrians, later by the Babylonians, and they will go into exile. There's no doubt about what was going to happen to those people. And verse 26 to 30, you can see there's war and destruction that's going to happen. Verse 25, therefore the Lord's anger burns against his people. His hand is raised up, he strikes them down, the mountains shake. Look at this in verse 26. Here they come, swiftly, speedily. We have the Assyrians coming, and then the Babylonians. Their arrows are sharp, their bows are strung, the chariot's wheels are like whirlwinds. Incredibly graphic, energetic language. You know, you can almost hear the chariots coming through those streets of Jerusalem. Right, they growl as they seize their prey and they carry it off with no one to rescue. In that day, they will roar over it like the roaring of the sea. And when I teach this to the HSC kids, they've got their exam tomorrow, so hopefully they'll remember some of it. We see the images of the Assyrian war machines, and they're just so graphic. And here, Isaiah has really captured it with their bows and their arrows and their chariots, and swiftly and speedily. So this is the introduction to Isaiah. You can see, okay, he's going to move towards the restoration, but currently he's looking at it as it is, with Judah, with Jerusalem, and with the people. Let's have a look, though, at the message of judgment that he brings. Okay, I've stepped a little bit out of the chapters 1 to 5 here, just so you can see how Isaiah, in these first chapters, is giving a message of judgment, and then he goes on to offer comfort. But I won't go through these in particular, but he is very condemnatory of Ahaz's alliance with Assyria. Ahaz went up, and he saw that he appealed to Tiglath-Pileser to come and help him as he was fighting against Israel, actually. And he is condemned for that. And while Ahaz is in Damascus, he sees some Assyrian gods, and he says, oh, I want those in Jerusalem. And he comes back and copies them. And we have the invasion of Sennacherib, of course. Right? The great king, the mighty king, the king of the universe, the king of the four quarters of the world, coming down and capturing 46 cities of Judah as he braves about, lays siege to Lachish, lays siege to Jerusalem, and that judgment is depicted there with Isaiah. He refers to the Babylonians coming down as well. Okay, the Assyrians went into met their demise at the hand of the Babylonians at the Battle of Carchemish, and then Babylon rises and invades, and Judah is taken captive. We had a look at that in verse 2 of chapter 1, where the people have been rebellious. Okay, so this is all the punishment that's coming against these rebellious people who have trampled the vineyard. Have a look at chapter 5, verse 1 to 7. It struck me as I was listening to this. The language here is just so beautiful. But you listen to the pathos here. Chapter 5, verse 1. Old sings the one I love, a song about his vineyard. Oh, my loved one had a vineyard on a fertile hillside. He dug it up and he cleared it of stones and planted it with the choicest vines. He built a watchtower in it and cut out a wine press as well. He looked for a crop of good grapes. And you can see this farmer here tending so carefully his vineyard. Oh, he's choosing and caring and nurturing and pruning. And he's so careful with love. And what does he find? He looks for good grapes. Oh, the disappointment. You know, I can sense this with Gary's garden. He's got this huge crop of tomatoes growing and some of them are going, like this. And he asks the nursery, what do we do? Oh, he's got something. You've got to pull them out and throw them away. He's devastated. He's really nurtured these tomatoes and he's got to throw them out. This is like God. But he looked for a crop of good grapes, having done all that care. Oh, all he found was bad grapes, bad fruit. And this is a lovely image here. And you've got a feel for God, okay? What more could have been done for my vineyard? What more could I do for you? When I looked for good grapes that only yielded bad. And so he says, I'll have to take it away. It's going to be destroyed. I'll have to break down the wall. I can't do anything with it. And it's so tragic. As you look through Isaiah with these studies over the next few months or however long you're doing it, keep an eye on this phrase, the day of the Lord. It comes up many, many times. You'll see that it refers the day of the Lord to Israel and the day of the Lord as well to the nations and the day of the Lord as well to Judah. But we can see particularly here in 2 verse 11 and 5 verse 30, Israel and the nations. This is a phrase that comes up a lot, the day of the Lord, the day of the Lord. And just keep a lookout for it, because it's certainly a theme that Isaiah has really used a lot. You can just see it there in chapter 2, verse 11. The Lord alone will be exalted in that day. And it comes up in that day, or the day of the Lord. It's an interesting theme that Isaiah repeats, because he knows that God's hand is going to come and there's going to be God's intervention. And woe betide those who are against God on that day. Juxtaposed against that, though, we have this wonderful message of salvation, which is again embedded in Isaiah. And beautiful, beautiful messages that counteract the tragedy that we have captured here, particularly in the first five chapters there. Well, we know that people are going to be restored from captivity. Wow, we've got this foreign king, Cyrus, rising. And he's going to be instrumental in allowing these people to come back to the land. Right, with the Medes and the Persians together, they're going to conquer Babylon and they're going to allow the people to return. An amazing instrument in God's hand that this foreign king is going to be there as part of the tools for God's restoration in Israel. So the Jews were allowed to return, of course, and that prefigures, of course, the deliverance from sin. Have a look at that in chapter 52, verse 7. A lot of layers in Isaiah which are amazing, and you'll probably become aware of them, particularly as you look through. Chapter 52, verse 7. How beautiful on the mountains are the feet of those who bring good news, who proclaim peace, who bring good tidings, who proclaim salvation, who says to Zion, your God reigns. And so we can see that we have this amazing offer of salvation that came through God's Son. And that salvation, of course, has been offered to us through the work of Jesus. And so we have those chapters that talk about the return of Christ. And in chapter 13 verse 10 and 34 verse 4, you'll see this echo in Matthew. Isaiah is the most quoted Old Testament prophet in the New Testament. So obviously that has to be an indication in itself. Come over to Matthew 24. I won't read these from Isaiah because you'll recognise them in Matthew, and this is just an example of how Isaiah is drawn on in Matthew 24, and they're words that you certainly know if you come over to Matthew chapter 24, verse 29. You'll know that this chapter is dealing with signs of the end of the age. Verse 29. Immediately after the stress of these days, quote, from Isaiah, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light. The stars will fall from the sky and the heavenly bodies will be shaken. At that time, the sign of the Son of Man will appear in the sky and all the nations of the earth will mourn. They will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of the sky with power and great glory. So back in Isaiah's time, they saw those images relating to the desolation that was coming on them by the Assyrians and by the Babylonians. We see this now in our day and age, of course, heralding the return of Christ. Not the Assyrians, they're not going to come down and darken our sun. Not the Babylonians, but we know that this is a sign that we can see that the heavenly bodies will be shaken and our Lord will be here. So these lovely messages of salvation also come out of Isaiah. Also embedded in Isaiah are lovely messages of compassion. And I'll just skip through these because the repetition of the language is just so beautiful here. When we see the compassion that God has on his people. In chapter 14, verse 1 and 2, I'll just read them for you. The Lord will have compassion on Jacob. Once again, he will choose Israel and will settle them in their own land. Aliens will join them, us, okay, and unite with the house of Jacob. Nations will take them and bring them to their own place, and the house of Israel will possess the nations. And so we have this beautiful image here of Yahweh having compassion on these people and settling them back in their own land. And of course we saw this in its primary sense in 48 and 1967. Have a look in chapter 43. Again, these lovely, lovely words of compassion. In chapter 43, verse 2. Verse 1. Oh, fear not. Fear not. I have redeemed you. I've summoned you by name. You are mine. When you pass through the waters, I will be with you. When you pass through the rivers, they'll not sweep over you. When you walk through the fire, you will not be burned. The flames will not set you ablaze, for I am the Lord your God, the Holy One of Israel, your Savior. And so he offers them these lovely reassurances that, look, it doesn't matter what happens to you, I'm there. I'll be your Savior. And we know that in chapter 3 there, it talks about how he actually saves them. In chapter 32, he talks about how the land is going to be renewed, no longer desolate. Chapter 32, verse 2, oh, each man will be like a shelter from the wind, a refuge from the storm, like streams of water in the desert and the shadow of a great rock in a thirsty land. And so the whole land is going to be renewed when Christ returns. He's going to provide a highway for the exiles as they come back, and he's going to summon the nations. Send Israel back. Send her back to her land. That's where she should be. So you can see these lovely messages, right? A whole mixture of messages in Isaiah, and these are obviously some of the messages you'll tap into as you look through the book. Other messages are of peace and safety when Christ returns. There's going to be a righteous king over the whole earth. There's no more oppression by the wicked. Jerusalem will be the city of the great king. And not only that, it'll be a wonderful light for us, the Gentiles, and us as part of the nations will be invited in and find salvation there. A lovely message there from Isaiah as he encourages us to be involved in that salvation process. Okay, let's get down to some nitty-gritties then. Picking up from chapter 1, verse 1. Right, now think of Isaiah. he's here at this time prophesying during this reign of King Uzziah. He's also called Azariah. So if you get those two names muddled up, it's understandable. Now we know Uzziah was actually born during his reign. And you can see that Uzziah had a very long reign, 52 years. And he was a very, very industrious man. He, when you look at the king's record, you see how he had building programs. He set up new townships around the place. He expanded the military. Loved agriculture. He had forests and orchards and vegetables. And very, very industrious man. And in that, he encouraged the worship of Yahweh. Now, I use the word Yahweh here because I'm used to doing this sort of stuff with my students. Tomorrow, they cannot refer to God as God, because who is God? Are you talking about Zeus? Are you talking about Asher? And so they have to identify the God of Israel as Yahweh, and people who worship Yahweh in the sort of studies lingo are Yahwists, and the religion is Yahwism. So if I default to that sort of terminology, it's because that's in my head. But they were encouraged there to worship Yahweh, because there was a multitude of gods that they could worship, readily available in the land. But no, they were encouraged to worship Yahweh. As I said to you, Isaiah promoted agriculture. His son had to act as a co-regent. Why? Near the end of his life, there are both two kings on the throne, Uzziah and Jotham. Why? What happened to Uzziah? Sick? What? Yes, exactly. What particular? Yes, leprosy. Remember, he went in and he wanted to act as priest, and he was smitten with leprosy. So his son comes on as co-regent, and he was struck with that leprosy. And during his reign, as I said to you before, there was this massive, massive earthquake. And it would have devastated the land. And look, we know what it's like here today. With all our technology, how long does it take for a country to recover from an earthquake? Where's Haiti? Where's it up to? People are still living in tents. What, 2 years later? And, you know, we know how devastating earthquakes can be. Okay, so he's co-regent with Jotham, so Uzziah now is in his ministry during the reign of this king. So what happens during this reign? Okay, he reigned for 16 years, and we know he was co-regent for about 10. He again was a strong Yahwist, but tragically, he wasn't supported by the people. And we often find that a lot of the kings like Hezekiah and Jehoshaphat and the other reformers had very strong ideas about how the people should act. And sometimes if they didn't worship Yahweh, if they didn't listen to what the king said, the option was death. So generally people said, okay, well, we'll do what the king said. But as soon as the king died, of course, phew, back to their pagan ways. And one of the regular HSC questions that comes up is assess the reforms of maybe a particular king like Hezekiah, or it will be assess the success of the reformers. And they've got to say, well, they were very successful while the king lived, but as soon as the king died, and that charismatic, powerful figure passes off the scene, and they revert back to their pagan ways. How amazing for our kids to actually be able to study this as an HSC subject. So we're very privileged to be able to do it. We know again, okay, he's improving the fortifications of Judah. Why is he doing that? Earthquake. He's got to build up Judah again and restore it and make it a strong defence. And so when you know a lot of the background to what happened, you can understand why he's so focused on rebuilding Judah. We know he actually tolerated idolatry, and I think some people in their minds practiced idolatry, but in some way, oh, it doesn't really matter, you know. I do really worship Yahweh, but, you know, it doesn't really... I don't know how they could accommodate it, but apparently they did. And we know, during this time, socially, economically, Judah was improving, and it was certainly a time of luxury and indulgence. And you can see this very clearly in so it talks about the women mincing around and all their their beautiful garments are going to be reduced to sackcloth instead of jewelry. They're going to be given chains. And so we know that they were dressed absolutely beautifully, and that was all going to be taken away from them. It's, in chapter 3, verse 24, instead of fragrance, there'll be a stench. So perfume was readily available. Beautiful sashes, well-dressed hair. They obviously had the means to attend to themselves very, very beautifully. Instead of fine clothing, they were going to be given sackcloth, instead of beauty branding. So just by looking at that, you can see also in chapter 16, the women of Zion are haughty, walking along with outstretched necks, searching with their eyes, tripping along with mincing steps, with ornaments jingling on their ankles. Okay. And so that was all going to be dashed away. But can you get an image as Isaiah is walking around Jerusalem? Here are these women mincing around with all their finery and just thinking that they are so wonderful. But meanwhile, what about the widow in the ecclesia? What about the fatherless in Jerusalem? Are they cared for? No, you are just totally selfishly pursuing your own way of life. And so we can see that certainly social indulgence and luxury is here. And that's also parallel with Isaiah's ministry. You have Amos and Micah and Hosea, and they are scathing about the conditions in Israel and Judah. They, you know, you've got your winter house, you've got your summer house, you're taking bribes, your justice is corrupt, and they're scathing. And that's what society was like. They didn't care. They were looking after themselves. And so in this sort of a society, Isaiah is trying to appeal to the people, to that remnant that he knew would survive. And in the course of Jotham's reign, he defeats the Ammonites. So, okay, while Isaiah's here, during the reigns of Isaiah, Jotham, he's got this internal struggles going on socially, economically, but you've also got external enemies such as the Ammonites. Now, Ahaz, a wicked king, wasn't he? Okay, abominable king. And we can be just so grateful that Hezekiah was able to turn his back on his wicked way of his father. Okay, he reigned 16 years, right, during the time of Isaiah. We know that Rezin, right, Damascus, and Pekah, Israel, made an alliance to fight against it. So you have Israel in the north aligning themselves with what we would call Syria today, and they're going to join forces and they're going to attack Judah. So Ahaz is in a fairly critical situation where you have two big enemies to the north about to attack. And so what does he do? He finds that he's powerless to help. And so what happens is casualties, a lot of the princes are actually taken captive, a huge amount of booty is taken, and so the economic state of Judah is reduced because of the impact of this attack by Syria and Israel. You've also got an attack by the Edomites. Right? Ahaz is in a pretty bad way. He's got two enemies to the north attacking him, taking booty, taking captives, taking the princes of the land away. Then you've got down in the south here, you've got Edom attacking. Then you've got over from the east, the Philistines attacking. So Ahaz is being attacked on all sides. And you can understand that Isaiah would be struggling to get a message through when all around them they're surrounded by enemies. So what does he do? What can he do? There's a new power on the horizon, the Assyrians. I'll ask Tiglath-Pileser to help me. And so he makes this alliance with Assyria, Tiglath-Pileser III, to help him against his enemies. And, of course, once you've done that, you are never free. And so the Assyrians would have imposed a tribute on him. he would have had to stay a loyal vassal state of Assyria. And of course, all that's weakening the nation. Right? Money is flowing out, and you're getting very little in return here apart from the protection, I suppose, of Assyria. And the tragedy here was Ahaz was confirmed in his religious apostasy, but as I said to you earlier, he went up to Damascus and he saw these Assyrian gods being worshipped, and he thought they were marvellous. And so he actually took a plan and sent it back to Jerusalem and had his workmen working on these gods. He brought them into the temple and they were on the corner of the street before he got back himself. And so they were all scattered throughout Jerusalem, and it sort of grieved Isaiah incredibly to have seen those there. So the consequences of Ahaz's reign are dramatic. Right? Economically, Judah now has been stripped. It's lost territory that Isaiah had gained. So its arable land has been reduced, its secure borders, the buffer zones have been reduced. Revenue's gone out, now it's going off to Assyria as tribute. So produce, which is normally relayed back into the land, is now being sent away. The tribute would have been, had to be delivered every year, and then they would have sent the emissaries up into Assyria to give that. Totally ruinous. So he emptied the treasury, stripped the temple to meet these economic demands of Assyria. But religiously, the impact during Ahaz's reign was also dramatic. So we know that he gave his allegiance to the Assyrian gods of Damascus. He copied the altar. And we can see there in chapter 2 how the native paganism just flourished in this time. Look at what they were doing. It's just terrible. Okay, look at it in chapter 2. And just, you can see there's a similar litany in the Kings and Chronicles records. But here, the land is full of idols. They bow down to the work of their hands, to what their fingers have made. And you think, why? Why? But have a look at Micah, because as I said to you just a moment ago, Micah is prophesying during this time as well. And he has similar thoughts. Where he is also really condemning, he's making a statement about the social conditions at this time. Micah chapter 5, and verse 12. Now these are going to be there for them to be destroyed, don't they? I will destroy your witchcraft, and you will no longer cast spells. I will destroy your carved images and your sacred stones from among you. You will no longer bow down to the work of your hands. I will uproot from among you your Asherah poles and demolish your cities. So you've got this list of things that are going on in Judah. Like witchcraft, with spells and divination and images and sacred stones and bowing down, and they're all going to be destroyed. And that's a similar list that you can see in Isaiah. And I think probably one of the heart-wrenching things that I just can't get my head around is that Ahaz actually offered his sons in the fire of Molech. And I see Hezekiah. Some people don't believe Hezekiah suffered this, but I believe that when we read about Hezekiah and we look at Isaiah chapter 52, his visage was scarred more than any man. And I believe that Hezekiah, that applies primarily to Hezekiah, but I also believe, of course, it refers to our Lord Jesus Christ. It's in the suffering servant prophecies of Isaiah. But can you imagine that little boy as a child being wove through the fire, right? And if you ever see photos of people who have been burnt, right, the incredible scarring that is left there. And imagine Hezekiah growing up, and every time he looked in the mirror, he saw these scars all over him, this disfiguration. And if anything would have determined your mind not to do that practice, would have been looking at the stars that these pagan idols had burned onto your face. And I think that would surely have been a motivation for Hezekiah to introduce the reforms he did. And we know too that, like Hezekiah, his son wasn't born until quite late in his life, you know, and so tragically, you know, he didn't seem to marry until very late. He married Tetzel, but Mary was married late, it seems, and his son was born very late, and, you know, who knows, you could write a good story about it. But so let's look at Hezekiah, right? A wonderful, wonderful king. He reigned for 29 years, and of course his first act was to go in there, cleanse the temple, get rid of those idols his father had put in place, and reopen the temple. And what a lovely experience for Isaiah, who was there encouraging him, showing him the way, and together they did this project. And in it, though, there was this division in society that was starting to show itself, where you had some of the court wanting to show their support to the Assyrians, but some in the court wanted to, let's get the support of the Egyptians. And so there was this faction, this polarisation taking place within the court that Hezekiah had to deal with. Okay, my suggestion is that he was passed through the fire as an infant. Just that quote there in 2 Chronicles 28 talks about what Ahaz did, and then the quotes in Isaiah 52 talk about his visage being marred. In chapter 28, verse 3, 2 Chronicles, we see he burned sacrifices. This is Ahaz. He burned sacrifices in the valley of Ben-Hinnom, and he sacrificed his sons in the fire, following the detestable ways of the nations the Lord had driven out before the Israelites. And so Hezekiah would have hated that for the vengeance. And we know he celebrated the Passover. He reinstituted Passover. Wonderful time of celebration. The people were so buoyed up by it. They said, oh, let's do it for another week. And they did, because they were just so overwhelmed by the joy that was being experienced in that celebration. We know he had incredible campaigns of trying to destroy the idolatry, and he did as much as he could. So during his reign, right, just near the beginning of Hezekiah's reign, the Assyrians came down under Shalmaneser. He died, Sargon finishes the siege, mops up, and then deports the Israelites back to Assyria, and you then have a bit of a vacuum until he resettles people in that land. And so during that time, Hezekiah would have appealed to any of the remnant there to come down and celebrate the Passover, which many did. Now he stops paying tribute to Assyria. And no one can do that without getting the wrath of Assyria. So Sennacherib now has come onto the throne. He's got Merodach-Baladan down in Babylon being a nuisance, so he has a campaign against him. Then the hill tribes, the north west, are rebelling, so he goes up and fixes them. And while that's happening, Isaiah, no tribute coming in from Judah. What's going on here? Hezekiah's not sending any more. And so then Sennacherib turns to the east and starts looking at mopping up the problem on the Mediterranean coast. And so he stops paying tribute. And I believe this is the time when the ambassadors come under Merodach-Baladan to congratulate him and support him in his rebellion against Sennacherib. Just keep in mind, Isaiah is not chronological, and also often the king's records are not chronological. And that often happens, doesn't it, in a book. When you're reading a novel, you'll sometimes follow that little person through, and then you'll come and follow that person through. The Bible's very similar. And so we tend to think, because that visit of Merodach-Baladan is towards the end of Hezekiah's section, that we think, oh, it must have happened at the end, but I believe it happened a lot earlier, and that was when he was showing, whoa, look what I've done here, I've fortified this city, I've got all this wealth, you know, I'm going to be secure against the Assyrians. And that's when God says, nah, that was a mistake. And we know he prepared for the invasion. It was inevitable. No one rebels against Assyria without some retaliation by Assyria. And so Sennacherib invades, and he demands tribute from Judah, and we know Jerusalem is besieged. And in Sennacherib's annals of that account, he says, Hezekiah himself I shut up like a bird in a cage, and he brags about the 46 strong walled cities that he captures. And it's amazing to read that in Sennacherib's record, which does tell so closely to the Bible. But we know Jerusalem is saved. Sennacherib goes back. He has another 5 campaigns, and then he's killed by his son. In the Bible, it sort of reads like he went home and was killed straight away. But there's quite a period of time between those two happening, and Sennacherib's no more. Okay, here we have Margie going through the Hezekiah's tunnel and Janet Hillhouse there. So we've got this reference in 2 Chronicles. It was Hezekiah who blocked the upper outlet of the Gihon stream and channeled the water down the west side of the city of David. And so he did these preparations. He knew Sennacherib would come. He knew Sennacherib would lay siege to the city, and he made these preparations. And as I said to you, the psychological warfare that the Assyrians employed against the enemy, part of it was shutting up Hezekiah in Jerusalem. And so you've got Hezekiah's tunnel here that snakes its way through here. It's about 500 metres long. It's on a gradient of about 0.6%, so it just flows. Margie, what's your experience? Tell us about it when you step in.
Well, it was really amazing because it is very wet, and yet it's very easy to navigate because it's quite a narrow tunnel. And all you can keep on thinking, particularly when you come out of it, you keep on thinking, how the hell did they know how to get through to the other side and do it so well? And it's just an unforgettable experience to just walk and realise that you're living part of the Bible.
And you can actually see the hatch marks on the wall of where Hezekiah's men have come. See how high the ceiling is there, and yet when we start in here, and so my suggestion is, you know, how as they came in, there's the inscription in the Istanbul Museum, which is a copy in the Jewish Museum, talking about they could hear the ticks on either side, and as they got closer, they finally broke through. And I think what happened actually was they came along here and they came along here, and there was an overlap. And so what they then had to do was drop that one down. So you start off quite low, you know, someone like Dick Hillhouse's height is, you know, it's a bit of a struggle, but then it gets much higher for the second half, and I think they had to then marry that up, which even in itself was a huge undertaking. And it's nearly half a kilometre, so it's quite a, take what, half an hour to walk through, I suppose. But, you know, given that if Margie didn't have her light on, and we've all got these little headlamps on, it's totally black, you know, you can't even see your hand in front of your face. But they do have like white stone painted, so you can actually see your way through the, that's Gary and I, and you can see there the hatch mark. Well, Hezekiah's men, he's making preparations for this invasion that he knows is going to come. Okay, so that's who Isaiah is prophesying during the end of Isaiah. Jotham, Ahaz, Hezekiah. So they're the four kings. And we've got this superpower breathing down their necks, which is Assyria. Now what I'd like to do, and I'll do this fairly quickly, is just go quickly through each of the chapters. Just the first 5, just so you've got some appreciation of the message, and then from there you can use that as a springboard into your other Isaiah studies. Now, look at chapter 1. Incredible rebuke. Oh, pretty powerful language, and you think, he's scathing in his criticisms and charges against you. Absolutely scathing. Oh, look at verse 3. Israel does not know, my people do not understand. Oh, sinful nation, a people loaded with guilt, a brood of evildoers. Whoa, you imagine a brother getting up on Sunday and starting to dress you down like that. You think, what's going on here? What a scathing rebuke. But he was stating it for what it was. And it is not a... Oh, why should you be beaten anymore? Why do you persist in rebellion? Your whole head is injured. Your whole heart is afflicted. And so he's really, you know, stating it as it is. And the people must have reeled in shock, you know, from the sole of your foot to the top of your head. There's no soundness. Whoa. Okay. So really strong judgment here against Judah. Look at verse 13. Stop bringing meaningless offerings. Your incense is detestable to me. Oh, his patient coming along on a Sunday and being told that what you're doing is detestable. Imagine that. Imagine how it must have shocked the people if they had any sensitivity to God's way. Oh, new moon, Sabbath, convocations. Oh, I cannot bear your inassembly. Tragic. Absolutely tragic. These are the people of God. You couldn't even bear what they were doing. Just couldn't bear it. And look at verse 16. Take your evil deeds out of my sight. And but he appeals to them, verse 18. Oh, come. Let's reason together on this. Come on. Look, your skins are like scarlet, verse 18. But they will be white as snow in my mind. I love you. Even though you're detestable, I'll wipe it away. Though they are red as crimson, they'll be like wool. If you are a willing and obedient. Okay? There's always an if, isn't there? You know, if you obey my word. And tragically, Jerusalem and Judah were not doing it. Look at verse 28. You rebels and sinners! Will both be broken, and those who forsake the Lord will perish. So it's a really strong language here in Isaiah in chapter 1 particularly. Have a look at chapter 2. We know there's a little change here where beautifully Isaiah shows, even in spite of all that that's gone on, I've talked about in chapter 1, you are going to be the recipient of wonderful blessings. And the mountain of the Lord's temple will be established as chief among the mountains. It will be raised above the hills, and all nations and strangers, many people will come and say, oh, come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of Jacob. So, in spite of all that wickedness that he detested, there was going to come a time in the last days, this was going to happen, and all that superstition and idolatry was going to be cast away. Look at verse 11 now. The eyes of the arrogant man will be humbled. The pride of men brought low. The Lord alone will be exalted in that day. The arrogance of man will be brought low. The pride of men humbled. This tragic reflection on the society. This pride, this arrogance, this idolatry that was just so evident there. And it must have just grieved Isaiah so much to see that. But he knew that in that last day, there would be a turnaround where people would say, oh, come on, let's go up to the house of the Lord. They would want to go up and they would want to worship him in truth. Okay, chapter 3. Again, we've got a lot of that in that day. So it goes on from chapter 2, verse 6, right through to chapter 4, verse 1. And you'll see in chapter 3, there starts off these woes. Woe. Chapter 3, verse 9, woe to them, they've brought disaster upon themselves. Woe to the wicked, verse 11, disaster's upon them, they'll be paid back for what their hand has done. And so he talks about the discipline that's going to take place on these people because of what they've done. They've embraced all these foreign religions, foreign gods, foreign practices, their superstitions, their divinations, the idols, the worshipping of the moon and the sun and the stars and sacrificing. They're going to have to face God's discipline for that, and that's when they will be given, they'll be crushed, and where we looked at earlier, there'll be stench, there'll be rope, there'll be baldness, there'll be sackcloth, there'll be branding, there'll be sword. That's all going to be a consequence of what they've done. Assyria would come Babylon would come, and that would happen. Okay, from chapter 2, sorry, chapter 4, verse 2, you can see again there's a shift away from this disciplinary language. Verse 3, those who are left in Zion, who remain in Jerusalem, will be called holy. So there's going to be a remnant, there's going to be a restoration, which will, look at that in verse 4, he will cleanse the bloodstains. In verse 6, there'll be a refuge, there'll be a hiding place from the storm. So there is going to be a place where you can escape the horrors and take refuge in God. And so that discipline will be replaced with God's restoration in those few verses in chapter 4. When we come over to chapter 5, though, we've got, again, refocusing on the judgment that's going to take place on Israel. We've got that beautiful song of the vineyard that we looked at, how God was so lovingly tending for his people, but he just couldn't find any decent fruit and he had to discard it all. And you've got these woes happening again. Look at verse 8. Woe to you who add house to house, join field to field, for no space is left and you live alone in land. So they're expanding their territory, not taking any care for the poor. Verse 11. Woe to you who rise early in the morning to run after your drinks. You stay up late at night and you're inflamed with wine. Oh, well, sitting around some places, don't they? Okay, so look, they're totally drunk. Oh, they're just living for the drink. Woe to those who draw sin along with cords of deceit. Right, they've got all these strings attached and there's sin and there's deceit and wickedness. Okay. Woe, verse 20, to those who call evil good and good evil. That's a bit of a reflection on today, isn't it? Who put darkness for light and light for darkness, bitter for sweet and sweet for sweet and bitter. I think of the word cool. Gee, that's cool. You know, and that's one of those words we have in our language. Well, is it cold, or is it cool, or is it hot, or is it, you know, is it good, is it bad? You know,
wicked,
yeah, oh, that's wicked. Yeah, that's another classic, isn't it? Woe to those who are wise in their own eyes and clever in their own sight. Woe to those who are heroes at drinking wine and champions at mixing drinks and so on. So you can see that, again, isn't it a reflection of what society was like? These elements were all there in this society that Isaiah was prophesying to, and no wonder God's judgment was coming against them. Just like today, no wonder God's judgment is going to come soon. No wonder when you see what's out in our world today. We live in our lovely sheltered little cocoons, don't we? We don't know what goes on there, and great that we don't. We don't need to know, we don't want to know. But you can understand. And we live in a fool's paradise here too, don't we, in Australia? And when you look at other people in those war-torn countries, how terrifying it must be. And so he stresses here that, no, you are going to go into exile. The Babylonians will come and you will be taken into exile. Look at that in verse 9. The great houses will become desolate. The fine mansions left without husbands. Can you imagine that? These beautiful summer homes, winter homes, palaces of ivory. Nobody in them. Taken out. Empty. Totally empty. That's amazing, isn't it? Can you imagine what it's going to be like when Christ returns? You walk out of your house. It's going to be empty. Okay? It's strange, isn't it? You know, something that we put so much story in, and maybe soon, it's just going to be empty. Verse 13, therefore my people go into exile for lack of understanding. Their men of rank will die of hunger. And so we've got this exile taking place. Verse 25, the Lord's anger burns against his people and his hand is raised and he strikes them down. And then we've got that graphic language, swiftly, speedily, arrows are sharp, bows are strung, chariots, whirlwinds, seas, prey, all that's going to happen in that day when the taken into exile. Now, so that's the first five chapters of Isaiah, and obviously he could only say, only go on from there with And you've got that beautiful verse there. I heard the voice of the Lord saying, oh, who can I send to try and fix this up? This is terrible. Can you understand it? Oh, you know why? Send me, I'll do it. Now, Isaiah, he couldn't respond in any other way, could he? When he saw how tragic the situation was, and there was going to be a remnant, and he wanted to work with that remnant, and he put his hand up straight away and said, here am I, send me. And we know these beautiful references to Isaiah, and look out for the Michigan. He is called a man of God. He is called the servant of the Lord, the messenger of the Lord. He was a seer. And a wonderful man as he goes there trying to turn back the people. And we can see there in chapter 6, verse 1, in the year that King Uzziah died, saw the Lord seated on a throne, high and exalted, and holy, holy, holy is the Lord Almighty. And so from there, he works with those people, with Hezekiah as well, and he tries to turn those people around. And as he works through those first half of the book, he's working hard to show the people the inevitable judgment that will come upon them. And as we know, towards the end of the book, though, he talks about the comfort that will come. And I just love this verse there in the end of the book. I am ready to create Jerusalem to be a source of joy, and her people to be a source of happiness. Jerusalem will bring me joy. My people will bring me happiness. And that's what God was working towards. And we look forward to that day when we know, hopefully so soon, that we'll go up to Jerusalem and there will be joy and happiness there.